Everybody, my name's Tony Goodens, Director of the LSE. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the school this evening Professor Amartya Sen, Master of Trinity College, Cambridge. Amartya has been spending most of the day here, as I understand it, attending seminars on his work, so it's very good of him to also do a public lecture. On top of all that, Professor Sen first came to England in 1953 at age 19. Arriving from India to study economics at Trinity College. He was at the Delhi School of Economics from 1963 to 1971 before coming to the LSE, where he taught in the economics department. Between 1977 and 1988, he taught at Oxford University. He then became University Professor of Economics and Philosophy at Harvard University, where he remained before moving back to the UK. In October of last year, as I'm sure every single person in this audience will know, Professor Sen was awarded the Nobel Prize for Economics. Meghnad Desai, of whom some people here might have heard, aptly observed that the award of the Nobel Prize, and I can quote from Meghnad, recognizes Amartya Sen's lifelong contribution to making economics serve the human purpose in a unique manner. His work has spanned social choice, economic development, famine, and poverty. He has combined humane philosophy and rigorous economics with the aim of bettering the lot of people. Professor Sen's best-known work challenges the common view that shortage of food is the most important explanation for famine. On the basis of studies of several catastrophic situations, he shows that famines have occurred even when the supply of food was not significantly lower than during previous years. It is a great honor and also a personal pleasure for me to welcome him here back to his old stamping ground. The title of his lecture this evening is The Evaluation of Freedom. Good hand for our Nobel Prize winner.
Well, I'd like to say how truly delighted I am to be back at LSE and, in fact, lecturing in this room, which is very nostalgic. I've given lectures in elementary economic theory here a number of times. I think in many ways it's my favorite hall because altogether, and I know that there's some video vision somewhere else also, but in this hall itself, it can accommodate 450, and somehow it always, in my mind, had the notion of being a closer hall and being a little bit, I wouldn't say intimate would be probably too much of an exaggeration, but certainly I wish more halls were constructed like this. It's certainly been one of the most pleasurable places for me to lecture in. So I'm delighted to have this opportunity again. The topic that was put down was evaluation of freedom, and I guess I should get on with that more or less straight away. At the end, I think there's going to be some question and answers, if time permits. How much time do we have altogether?
About 4 hours.
All right, under those circumstances then.
Well, a quarter of an hour, maybe.
Right. Well, there are really three different questions I want to ask. Evaluation of freedom, why? Why do we want to do it? Evaluation of freedom, what? What are the things that we would like to evaluate? And the last question, as you might possibly guess, is how? Namely, how might we go about doing it? I should mention that in this I'm drawing on two books of mine which have been in some state of completion now for over a year and a half without it actually going through the copy editing stage, because I'm hoping all the time to revise it and all the time postponing it, a situation that must be known to Tony. And I'm afraid that is still in that tradition. One is a book called Development as Freedom, which will be published. It's a more popular book to be published by Knopf. And the other is Freedom, Rationality, and Social Choice, and there is a possibility of it either being published by OUP or by Harvard or both, and we have to decide on that still. The The first is more a development work which applies the ideas of freedom, and some of that will come into this talk also. The second is a more theoretical work. These were my Kenneth Arrow lectures, which began in 1991 in Stanford. I was privileged to give the first set, and several people who gave lectures after me have gone past me, so I'm a real sense of guilt of not having completed, but that often happens, I'm afraid. I've not been able to keep up with others in that respect. But at the moment, what I would like to do today is to comment on some of the problems that come up, obviously not the more technical part of the Arrow lectures, but some of the intellectual issues that lie behind them. Now, the why question raises immediately the issue as to whether freedom is an important thing to study. Now, in many standard evaluative approaches, it doesn't figure at all. For example, if you took welfare economics, which is the standard normative branch of economics, freedom is not a concept that's invoked. Welfare, yes. Utility, yes. Maybe living standard even, possibly. But freedom, not really. Freedom is seen as something which may be relevant as an instrument, but not important in itself. Now, it's that view which is disputed in going into evaluation of freedom as an important subject, which may have relevance even for welfare economics and for a number of other fields, possibly philosophy, political science, the social sciences in general. The other question is there something to evaluate? Is freedom a matter, as some people, particularly libertarians sometimes put it, is either you have it or you don't have it. Not a question of evaluating it more, less, etc. It's a kind of what we economists tend to think of as zero-one kind of dichotomy. Are you free or are you not? Now, is that point of view correct? If it were, then evaluation of freedom, well, you could still say it's evaluation, but it would be a rather degenerate kind of evaluation under those circumstances. Now, I have to, since I've got two other questions also, so I should be reasonably brief about this, I would say that the why question about the importance is resolved by noting that in many different ways we all regard freedom to be quite important and not just as an instrument. That is, if you think about situations when we are denied a choice, even if we might have chosen what is actually given to us, we might still think that something is really being lost in not having the opportunity of deciding what is it that we would ourselves like. Now, the outcomes could be the same in terms of commodities, or for that matter, even in terms of the bodily conditions with which we end up. But presence or absence of freedom could make a difference. For example, the director made reference to works on famine. Well, starvation, with which famine is primarily concerned, in terms of commodities as well as bodily states with which you end up, may be very like fasting. And yet, they're not the same. They're different between a person who is in the same situation of not taking food, in one case out of choice because he or she wants to make a religious point, or like Mahatma Gandhi, a political point, is quite different from a person who is simply not able to buy food. It's not within his or her freedom, within her opportunity to actually have that food. There's a distinction, even though the culmination situation is much the same. Incidentally, for those of you, I know this is a very mixed audience, for those of you who are concerned with more technical issues, the distinction between two ways of seeing outcomes, what I call culmination outcome and what may be called comprehensive outcome, to which I will make a reference every now and then, is discussed at the technical level fairly extensively in a paper of mine in Econometrica of July 1997, called Maximization and Act of Choice. Now, the main distinction here is the culmination outcome is what I end up with, in this case, ending up without food. The comprehensive outcome describes how I got there, whether by choice, volition, or by necessity, because I simply couldn't afford to buy food. And that in the space of comprehensive outcomes, they are distinct outcomes. In the space of culmination outcomes, they are not. A lot of economics, unfortunately, is concerned with culmination outcomes. And even standard models of general equilibrium theory have that feature. And I think that is not to its glory. It's often a necessity because it becomes too complex. But that we do lose out a good deal, namely the role of freedom in that context. Let me give an example from the issue of how it might be relevant to a practical problem, which often comes up, namely the merits of the market mechanism. Now, I'm actually a partial skeptic of the market. I think the markets work pretty well in some cases, but not in others. But there are a lot of people, including, I don't doubt, many here, who take the view that markets generally are good, a force for good, and indeed, pretty much always, they perform well. But the word perform well immediately raises a way of judging markets, which I would argue, if you took a freedom-centered view, is a bit of a mistake. That is, if you were to look at the debate surrounding the market mechanism, say in the 1920s and 30s, even 40s and 50s, in fact, the debate began by saying there were socialist writers, Baronet and others, saying, you know, a socialist economy will do this and that. And there was a disputation from defenders of basically free market arrangement, capitalist, competitive capitalist arrangement, Ludwig von Mises being one big name in that, arguing that that's not possible. A state could not possibly have that much information to be able to allocate everything with the efficiency that a market mechanism can. Because the market mechanism, everyone looks after his or her interests. And therefore, we end up in a situation which is extremely efficient. And formally, it's called Pareto optimality or Pareto efficiency. But without going into the structure of it, it's easy to see that the market will have an efficiency that is arrived at in this way. And then there was a debate, can a socialist economy do it? One kind of debate as to whether computers and information technology could move so far ahead that centralized planning could do it. Or could be do it through a mimicking process within a socialist economy. Oscar Lange outlined such a procedure. Abba Lerner in the London School of Economics developed his Economics of Control, which discusses a socialist economy operating that way. And all these were trying to produce the result that the market economy would produce. And the argument was that, well, maybe it wouldn't work. Oscar Lange himself later said, well, actually, this probably isn't, when he became very powerful in Poland, where after he returned there, he did not actually implement any of these things. And it was the argument really was that maybe what can be done by centralized planning was underestimated by he, Lange, himself. And that was one kind of debate. And people might say that in hindsight, that doesn't look as if he was right in claiming that. But there is another debate here, which is lost, which is it's a dog that did not bark. Supposing it were the case that there is a centralized, terribly omniscient, central dictator who knows about everything, who knows everyone's taste, everyone's preference, everyone's productivity, prices of everything, and values of everything, and proceeds from there to allocate it centrally. And produces exactly the same result as the market economy. I'm leaving out the equity issue, which is a problem with the market, but leaving that out, mimics every way a market outcome. The only difference is, in one case, you decide whether to work, how much to work, where to work, what to do with your income, what commodities to buy, and how to consume them. In the other case, you're being commanded to do all those things. Go there, work like this, get that salary, use your income to buy these commodities. He knows your tastes, you see. And he tells you to buy all these commodities. You follow his command, and you end up with the same result. Would we regard both the systems to be equally good? I would argue that they're essentially different, because in one case, I'm being commanded to do something, which in the other case, I'm choosing to do myself. So I would say that in some way, the classic defense of the market mechanism missed out perhaps the most important characteristic of the market, namely its compatibility with individual freedom, the fact that each person is taking decisions of his own and of her own. And that requires you to be interested in freedom and how this process, how the process is through which it comes about. If you look at the general equilibrium model, which is a model of a market economy with many, many commodities, if you look at the way they are characterized, commodities, utilities, etc., and let's assume that somehow you actually your utilities get affected by freedom, that would be one way of looking at it. Otherwise, in terms of the commodity space and your preference ranking over commodities, it's exactly the same. They're isomorphic, they're exactly the same. The only difference is that who is making the choice, which is itself an important variable, has no accommodation in that structure. You may indirectly bring in by saying you'll be very depressed if you cannot decide yourself. But that's really not giving freedom its due. It's bringing in not because freedom is valuable, but because happiness is valuable. If you're unhappy not having the freedom, well then, my God, that's serious. But people who take freedom seriously might think that even if you're not unhappy as a result of that, there is something serious being lost, namely the opportunity, the freedom, the liberty of making your own choices. Now, again, any example of this kind is sufficiently rich to permit various arguments. I could think of a counter-argument and a counter-counter-argument. We can go on. What I'm trying to establish is not that this distinction is clearly very important, but it's arguably a very important distinction. And if there is no room for it, no accommodation of it, something quite serious is being lost through this process. So with all these examples, starving and fasting, the market economy, different ways of looking at it, we have distinctions which indicate that this is a serious subject. Oddly enough, though in modern economics freedom is not a variable, in classical writings, people of extremely different schools of thought had agreed very much on this subject. I mean, I think the mantle that's carried in the contemporary world, I think most eminently, is that of another LSE person, namely Friedrich Hayek, because who remained totally consistent in valuing freedom. Indeed, he went to the extent of saying it's got nothing to do with your preference fulfillment. Indeed, the less it is even possible, he had a very contrary thing, quite often Hayek had, take a sensible point and drive it to the point that to an extremity where it can't, himself making it quite implausible, saying that actually, less keenly you desire it, more important may it be, because desire fulfillment isn't itself a value, and we might agree on that. But you see, you may miss it out on that, but my God, since you haven't demanded it, never got it, when you do get it, that would be a great achievement. Now, I don't really quite buy that argument, but certainly Hayek remained quite loyal to that. But this is the territory of John Stuart Mill, and maybe even one of the few subjects, and John Stuart Mill and Karl Marx had some point of agreement. They had a kind of asymmetrical relationship. Karl Marx hated John Stuart Mill. Every reference to John Stuart Mill is negative. John Stuart Mill, it's not clear, was aware of the existence of Karl Marx, so there are no references at all. On the other hand, if you think about it, they speak very similarly. I don't mean only Capital, but there too, in Capital, for example, where he's discussing, well, is there anything good that's happened in the contemporary world? He said there's only one good thing that's happened in the contemporary world, and that is the American Civil Wars. And the liberation of the slaves is actually a remarkable achievement. And in fact, we know that that's consistent with his position, not only the manuscript of 1844, but also German ideology, and eventually even Critique of Gotha program, had features which emphasizes the freedom of choice very importantly as a factor of great importance. Incidentally, on the subject of slaves, it's quite interesting to find, for example, from the writings study that was produced by Bob Fogel and Stan Engerman, even though it was criticized in some respect, but one of the things that indubitably got established, that judged in many standard criteria, slaves were doing terribly well. In fact, I remember a left-wing critique of it in the Union of Radical Political Economy Journal, ridiculed it by calling it, the book was called Time in the Cross, and the review called it Good Time on the Cross. But the point that was being made is that their income levels was higher than that of free laborers in Chicago and elsewhere. The life expectancy was higher than not only Northern America, but Europeans too, in that which of course at that time was higher than the American. And in fact, it indicated that in order to say why is it that it was such a abomination, you have to go into the issue of freedom of decision making, who was deciding what there. So the subject is important, and I need hardly mention that writings of non-economists like Berlin earlier, think of T.H. Green and others, have really emphasized why freedom may be so important. What about the question that there is nothing to discuss, since there is either you have freedom or you don't? Well, I think that's not a right way of looking at it. It's true that if certain processes are violated, you might say a person does not have freedom in the full sense. But to say that every case of violation of that process is an equal reduction of freedom, I think would be a mistake. Let me give you an example, which I actually used. I feel bad about reusing it. I used it about, I guess, 18 years ago, and I hope people have forgotten if anyone ever read it. And it deals with a case of a person, let's call him Bill. He decides to spend a Sunday at home reading books, lazy Sunday at home. He had a lot of opportunity to go out, see a movie, do hundreds of other things, but didn't. Chose to have stay at home and read books. Consider a second counterfactual scenario where a strong-armed man arrives and forces Bill to do certain things no matter what he wants. And in the first case, he forces Bill to stay at home and read books. Now, in this case, the culmination outcome is exactly the same. He's reading books, staying at home, but there is a real difference. There is a loss of freedom, no question. In one case, he could have gone out. That counterfactually, he could have gone out. In the second case, he couldn't. He's simply told that he will be shot if he tries to come out. He must stay at home and read books. There is certainly a violation of freedom. Consider another scenario in which the person is forced, again, no matter what he wants, to do something, but not in this case, stay at home, but read a book. But my original example was, I think, to do something which you would never consider doing, like taking a dip in the sewers. Now, when I used that in a class, one of the students told me that, could you use less disgusting examples, please? So I will not use that example. And he was forced to take a bath in I then said, chilly, half-frozen Charles River, but Thames would do, which he would never consider doing. Now, there is again a loss of freedom. He was forced to do something. Do we want to say that there is nothing to discriminate between these two? There is loss of freedom, both when he is forced to stay at home and read a book, as well as when he is forced to take a dip in the river, chilly, icy river, which he would never consider doing otherwise. I would say there is a loss of freedom, but to say that there is an equal loss of freedom is a mistake. There is something to discuss here about the evaluation of freedom, namely, how do we rank the loss of freedom, even if you can't quantify, can we rank, partially order, the loss of freedom involved. This example, by the way, is quite an interesting one because it brings out another distinction which is going to be quite central from this point onwards in this talk. That is that there are two rather distinct aspects of freedom. One is its process aspect, and the other is what I would call its opportunity aspect. That's at least what I called it in the Kenneth Arrow lectures. The process aspect is dealing with how this comes about and who takes the decision, under what freedom, what kind of knowledge, etc., etc., etc. The opportunity aspect is substantively what is it that you have opportunity of achieving. Now, one way of looking at it would be to say the person who is forced to stay at home against, no matter, not against his will, in favor of his will, but forcefully, is actually have the same opportunity to do what he would have done anyway. His opportunity in terms of the actual choice is not reduced, but his opportunity in terms of options are reduced. On the other hand, his opportunities are severely violated when he is forced to take a dip in the icy river because he would have never done that otherwise. So that there is an asymmetry between the opportunity aspect being somewhat reduced, mainly in terms of his second best and third best and other alternatives, where the process aspect is clearly, forcibly, fully violated. Now that raises the question as to whether we could in fact think of freedom as consisting of these two different components. To what extent they remain separate? Now, I think they're separate. They are all right. The question is, can you integrate them? And quite a lot of the Arrow lecture is concerned with that issue. Now, once you are considering comprehensive outcomes, it could be argued that indeed you may go some direction towards integrating them. Because if it is the case that you could say, well, it's true that I had the opportunity of reading the book that I wanted to read anyway, but I did not have the opportunity of reading the book out of free choice, that opportunity was denied. So by enriching the space of outcomes, by looking at comprehensive outcomes, I could say it wasn't the same outcome. The process difference made it a different comprehensive outcome. And given that fact, maybe in the space of comprehensive outcomes, you could make a distinction. I think that takes us in somewhat in that direction to integrate. I don't think you can fully integrate it. Because those who are really serious process libertarians, which would include Friedrich Hayek, would say, really, it didn't really matter. Or he would even say probably didn't matter, but in any case, more moderately, it could be said, you could not really see that as conditional on the person's preference over comprehensive outcomes. Supposing a person hasn't thought really very much about it, and proceeds really not to attach any importance to process, and says, what the hell, I mean, I was going to read the books anyway, you forced me to read the books, nothing's lost, I'm reading it. Now, Hayek might regard that such a person to be rather insensitive, but more importantly, he would argue that that does not eliminate the nastiness that's happening, the unacceptability of what's happening, because that is not contingent on a person valuing it. On to elaborate the argument further, even if it's contingent on the person valuing it, the value of it may not rest on the importance that the person himself or herself attaches to it. That is, you might wish to have a different metric on processes, which is very different from processes included in comprehensive outcome, and the metric that you will get from the preferences by looking at that, at how the person himself looks at it. That is, you might say that some people may reject a society in which people's freedom are violated even though they actually don't mind it. In fact, that relates to an important issue that Azar Berlin discusses and discusses very well, that one of the things that happens with tyranny is that you may lose the courage to desire freedom. So in that situation, when you don't have the courage to lose freedom, may not resent it. Something is lost, but it's not noticeable in the plane of your preferences. You have to look for other information, other ways of evaluation in order to indict it. I would tend to think that these two features remain to some extent not reducible into a combined feature. Well, what about the other? Can we get everything into process rather than everything into opportunity? Can we do that? Well, I would say perhaps not again, because it would really matter what opportunity you have. In some ways, you could say that the process of my being forced to jump into a river, namely being forced to do something, is very similar to the process of my being forced to read a book that I would have read anyway. And yet, they are different because my evaluation of these two outcomes are different. They are connected. Or another way of looking at it, which may be a more natural one for economists to look at it, is to say you have to be concerned not only with the choices you actually had, but what you would have chosen counterfactually. That is, given the choice between taking a dip in an icy cold river and reading a book which you would love to read, you would have preferred the latter. Given that fact, the Hobson's choice of reading the book, forced to read the book, is not as much of a denial of freedom of choice as the Hobson's choice of being forced to jump into the river, because given the choice between the two, you would have chosen to do one rather than the other. Now, that would be one way of doing it, and you know, one of the things I try to do in the Arrow lectures is to discuss whether there are differences between these ways of looking at it. There are some, but I think that's one way, certainly, of looking at this issue. I'll come back to that problem again a little bit, But let me proceed now, a bit beyond that, to the how question. We have dealt with why, importance, can't be just done 0-1. What, opportunity, as well as processes, how. Now, I have to report that processes, how to assess processes, what kind of a violation, to say a very bad violation of process, very little violation of process, this requires much more thinking than I have done, and I have not seen anyone else's discussion of this either. I know that people talk about that sometime. I was quite impressed when, at the time of the emergency in India, when the then Mrs. Gandhi's government suppressed the basic fundamental rights, and there was a agitation which ended in an election where the government fell, and it was an election that was fought on the issue of freedom, in which incidentally makes the point that even the poorest of the world electorate may worry about freedom in a way that very often we are told they don't, until bred people don't worry about freedom. That's certainly not brought about by any voting behavior. You get it only from those countries where people don't have vote, and you're told they would have, for them, bread is more important. But then the question is, why don't you give them a choice? And wherever the choice is given, it ended up being quite important. What about the issue of I was talking about the emergency, and how much of a violation of freedom it was. I'm just quoting an absurd statement. Is it almost a reductio ad absurdum? One of the government stakes and saying people are worried that there are people who are upset. The vote has not yet taken place, so we don't know how many people are upset. Some people have agitated, gone in prison, and one statement that came was to say only a small proportion of the Indian population is in jail at this time. Now, in terms of judging how badly the process had gone wrong, it's certainly true that if everyone was in jail, you regard that to be more scandalous than if only 1% of the people were in jail. So there is an issue there, and it is a reductio ad absurdum of that, what we are looking at. But I don't quite know how to deal with it. I don't think 0-1 does, even for process. Processes get robustly violated, mildly violated. It's a very complex. Someday I intend to do more work on that. I have to at this moment report that I haven't done that work, and I would just say there is a big issue here. What about opportunity? Now, here there is a kind of parting of the ways which often we see. One is to say opportunities has to be judged with respect to the preferences of the people themselves. The argument isn't that a person is necessarily better off by following his or her own preference. That's a different argument. That's a welfare economic argument. We're not giving that. We're saying as far as freedom is concerned, certainly is better promoted by a person having the choice to exercise her own preference in that. So the preferences that would be reflected in her choices would be the natural basis of judging freedom. Now, I find that position plausible, though I would presently introduce a qualification on that. The other argument on the other side says, well, this is a confusion. Preference fulfillment has something to do with utility, nothing to do with freedom. Freedom is having a range of choice. How many options do you have? And following that line, and again, a reductio ad absurdum, are theories where you have measurement of freedom according to the number of alternatives you have. Sometimes called by set theory, cardinality of the set of options, number of elements in it. Now, this doesn't work very well if things are infinitely variable, because they may be both infinite sets, but when they're finite cases, you could get a very nice ranking out of that. The question is, will you be getting a good ranking of freedom out of this? Now, in some ways, it seems plausible to say, did you have choice? Did you have many options? And we seem to be asking that question. But supposing told you that, look, both these persons were equally unfree. I don't know why you're weeping about this miserable man. Miserable he is, I know, but that's something about welfare. But freedom, gosh. The other guy had choice of a good life, a terrific life, an extraordinarily fulfilling life, and an ecstatic life. And this one had an equal choice. He had the option of being shot in the morning, hanged in the afternoon, quartered or whatever that is, in the evening, etc. And that he had four choices. So did he. Now, if you think that this is absurd, I think underlying that is some notion that he would prefer to have a good life rather than being quartered and an ecstatic life rather than being hanged in the morning and so forth. So that the material difference between your preferences could, must count somehow into the story. I don't have any difficulty in arguing that preferences must count. Now, the problem that comes up, however, comes either from those who simply primitively think choice, range of choice, number of alternatives is natural, and there are other which are sophisticated axiomatizations which says, well, okay, you may not think counting the number is right, I will convince you, and I'll give you axiomatics. Now, there are a whole lot of axiomatics which, again, I'm skipping. This is not the right occasion to discuss it. But there are, for anyone who is interested, there's a whole mathematical appendix to the Arrow lectures in the book called Freedom, Rationality, and Social Choice, which when it comes out, I hope you will buy. And in the appendix, you will see all this discussed. But I'll discuss the two axioms easily. Some of these axioms are coherence axioms, and some of these are substantive. Let's take a coherence axiom. Suppose you think you have more or as much freedom in A as in B, and as much freedom in C as in D. And suppose A, B, C, D, none of them have any common elements at all. Then it sounds plausible to argue, since you have exactly as much in A as in B, in C as in D, then you have exactly as much freedom in A union C, that is A together with C together, as you have in B union D. And this goes by various names. I think Patrick Soupy's, a logician, was the first to propose a condition very like this. So that sounds, in many contexts, quite plausible. Now consider a substantive axiom. Consider a person with just a Hobson's choice. He has no choice. Either he has X, X only, but that's it, no or. In the other case, he has Y, Y only, no option, that's it. Very plausible to say that he has exactly as much freedom under the Hobson's choice of X as he has under Hobson's choice of Y. And if you say, well, but he prefers X to Y, yes, but he can't choose. He has no freedom, clearly, because he cannot choose anything. He has zero freedom. And therefore, Hobson's choice of X gives him exactly as much freedom as Hobson's choice of Y. Well, now put the two together. Suppose there are two sets with 37 options each. Take one option from each. Hobson's choice of X1 and Y1. Well, equal freedom-wise. Hobson's choice of X2 and Y2. Put them, union them together using the union axiom earlier. So X1 and X2 give you exactly as much freedom as Y1 and Y2. And you've got it. What pompously you might call transfinite induction. You'll get to the 37 alternatives all right. And say, well, if once you have said that Hobson's choice, no matter what the alternative is, give you exactly as much freedom, given this composition axiom, you must accept its cardinality, and cardinality alone counts. Not defending it, but showing that result, Prashanta Patnaik did a paper a long time ago of great interest, and there are many other axioms arriving at that axiomatic structure. Now, taking this, one would have to say you have to break at the point of Hobson's choice yielding the same freedom. Same freedom, quote-unquote, of choice, if you like, yes. But when we're talking about freedom, we are talking also about what Isaiah Berlin calls freedom to lead the kind of life that you would have forgotten the exact how it finishes, that you value or that like to lead to, that you would desire, whatever it is. The freedom to lead the kind of life that you would desire is not the same when Hobson's choice drives you into an ice-cold river compared with the case when Hobson's choice drives you into reading a book which you would have read anyway. If you accept that, then clearly you cannot go by cardinality, and you cannot go by cardinality even in the case of Hobson's choice. You're always being preference-driven. And that I've got a few other arguments in that direction, but I won't present them because I want to stop really at 6:30 to leave some room for discussion. That would give me about 45 minutes. That's not bad, actually. Assuming I can manage to carry it out. We have to see that still. If that's the case, then we seem to be, when it comes to opportunity, we haven't talked about processes. When it comes to opportunity aspect of freedom, we ought to be driven by preferences. But then people find this very unsatisfactory. We had a whole range of seminars, all-day seminars. Today I have a lot of seminars on my work. I was very grateful for that, arranged by Stickard, Telesi. And I have to say that I'm very familiar with my work now. But there was a seminar in Politeia in Milano, which was actually concerned with my work on liberty, and all day I had presentations as well as critique. And Ian Carter, among others, strongly argued that this preference way of looking at it must be a mistake. Preference is concerned with utility, not so much with freedom. Because after all, if you're really concerned with preference, then as long as you get the most preferred alternative, that's what you've got. So that way is like utility. If you have a budget triangle, now some of you who are not economists may not know what a budget triangle is, but if you have a given amount of income and you've got some commodities and certain alternative bundles of commodity you can buy with it, all that is represented in a triangle for some obscure reason that I needn't go into now. And then what's the value of it? Well, the value of it is that you pick one alternative. It gives you some option. It's instrumentally important. After you picked it, if somebody says, well, what if leaving that, everything else is removed? Well, it doesn't change anything. You would have picked that anyway. In terms of the way utilities are defined and general equilibrium analysis is conducted, you will say, yeah, it's the same outcome. It's exactly the same outcome that's emerged. And this is something which I discussed earlier in the context of what is it that makes markets interesting. And so in that context, you might say, well, if you're really driven by preference, well, you won't get anywhere with freedom, will you? Well, you might. And why? Well, let's run through some of the arguments. I'll give basically four different arguments. One is, and this is an argument which I already stated in a different case, in a different context, so let me just state it very briefly. If your preferences are defined over comprehensive outcomes, not just culmination outcome, you may have preference as to how a decision is brought about. You go to somebody's place and you're being offered delicious burgundy and orange juice, and you know that you really don't want to drink too early to drink burgundy at that moment. You want to have the orange juice, and you choose to have orange juice. Counterfactual scenario arrived. This guy says, I know what you're going to choose. Here's an orange juice. And you say, well, I could have chosen that burgundy. And he says, well, I know what you would have chosen. Am I mistaken? And you said, no, you're not mistaken. You're quite right. So what do you resent? Well, I resent I didn't have the choice, though I would have chosen exactly the same thing. So that is a preference over comprehensive outcome. And once that is brought in, obviously, you could really make a distinction. That is, picking from a market economy, from a budget triangle, as I called it, picking a commodity bundle is not the same thing as that commodity bundle being given to me by Mr. Stalin on the basis of a decision that you have that commodity bundle. There's a distinction, since the processes are not the same. Second, and this is, I don't know how much importance to attach. It's a slightly different kind of argument. It has been presented forcefully, and I ought to share it with you. That is to say, there may be an uncertainty about your taste and your own preference. An economist called Jarlene Koopmans originally raised it, and the problem was decisively analyzed by both David Krebs and by Kenneth Arrow. By David Krebs, by using a set of axioms, which is like that of choice under uncertainty. The story is this, and it's much easier to understand if you're dealing with the future. I don't know what my taste will be in the future. Therefore, when I am deciding what commodity choices I should have in the future, I incline in the direction of flexibility, having more choices, because I can't really predict what my choice would be. Once I arrive at that point, of course, there will be one preference or the other, but I don't know that yet. There's an uncertainty today. And therefore, I want more options, not knowing what my preference would be. And by an extension, you could even perhaps apply it not so much in the distant future, but to the passage of time, even in the very near future, and even in the evening. You might be guaranteeing, you don't know what kind of a mood you would be, and you might be actually keeping options open for the evening, which we often do, and this may be quite important. This is a slightly different kind of case, because once you are actually there at that point, you have no further use for the options. The options arise at a prior point of time when you don't actually know what your preferences yet are. But yet, it's certainly one kind of consideration, and I will not attach great importance to it, but you could play it that way. And if you want to look at the axiomatic structure of that, there is one presented by David Krebs and Kenneth Arrow in his article in A Fresh Shift for Me, edited by Kosik, Basu, Suzumura, and Patnaik, actually gives a simpler axiomatization of that. Third, and here I think we are hitting some ground, really substantive ground, I believe, even for at any moment of time, doesn't have the tension of uncertainty applying only prior moments. And that is incompleteness. Supposing your preference orderings are not complete. Now, you may still have a maximal choice. Maximal choice is defined as choosing something to which there is nothing better, or in the context of knowledge, nothing known to be better. It's maximal choice. Optimal choice is to choose something which is at least as good as every other alternative. Many, many years ago, in 1972, when I gave my inaugural lecture here, which was later published in Economica, I remember wrestling with that distinction, even at that time. So if you think there is a certain air of monotony to my choice of themes, you're right. And the kind of example you can think of is, say, Buridan's ass. You probably know the story of Buridan's ass. There's an ass, donkey, which faces two haystacks, is very hungry. But both these haystacks look very luscious. It cannot decide which one is better, can't even decide that one is at least as good as the other. And it goes on dithering, being an optimizer, looking for the best haystack, and dies of starvation. Now, a maximizer will have no difficulty in it, because as long as you don't know which one of these two are better, by choosing either, you are choosing something that you do know to be better than, namely compared with starvation. On the other hand, there is no other option which is known to be better, namely the other haystack. So maximization has a lot of merit in it as an act of choice, as a strategy of choice. On the other hand, when it comes to freedom, here not only is it the case that you resent being given the orange juice rather than the burgundy, but maybe it's the case you didn't actually, it's not the case that you really knew that you wanted to have the orange juice, or you thought that everything considered the orange juice will be better than the burgundy. You were in two minds. You couldn't compare them, and then you said, well, you know, you don't like dithering. So you picked one of them. Could have been either of them. So happened the orange juice was next to you, picked it up. You could have been the burgundy. You picked the orange juice. Now to say, we will deny you, you clearly, since you picked the orange juice, denying burgundy will not mean anything, would be no loss for you. I could say, look, it's not even the case that it was my optimal choice. I didn't know that it was better than the other, or at least as good as the other. I simply could not determine between the two, and I picked one of them. So under those circumstances, even though preference is doing a work in maximal choice, and the Econometrica paper I referred to goes into that issue also quite a bit, quite extensively, preference is doing a good deal of work in maximal choice, as long as maximal choice is not optimal choice, to say that there is no loss in the denial of option is a non sequitur. You're not able to say that. So when there is incompleteness, there is a problem. Fourthly, there is the issue of what we may call autonomy. And that is to say, I'm actually not going to be finished in 3 minutes. I'm going to take more like 8 or 9 minutes. I may not take the full hour, but I will take something like that. The autonomy is to say, well, look, yes, indeed, I determined what I wanted, I chose it. I do two things. I decided first what I preferred. Second, I decided what to choose between orange juice and burgundy. But the first decision is quite important too. It was for me to determine my preference, not for you. Even if I can predict it, I could have revised it. I could have hoped to revise it. This kind of consideration could be quite important if you're trying to cultivate a taste, the kind of issue that, in a kind of very informal way, Tibor Skitovsky discusses in The Joyless Economy, namely that you might wish to be wanting, you may have a preference, but you might wish to cultivate a taste for good music. You may actually never do it, but you all the time want to have the autonomy of deciding to go for that in that direction, and you don't want others to take it away. So there you would say, it's for me to choose, not for you. That was the first argument we used already earlier. And the other is to say, it's for me to decide what to prefer, not for you to predict or determine on my behalf. Even if you can fully predict it, I am a free agent. There was no necessity for me to choose it. The distinction between what I prefer and what I necessarily prefer is very important here. That the fact that you can predict it does not mean that I necessarily prefer it. Very early, long time ago, when I used to be interested in determinism and free will, this turned out to be quite an important distinction between necessary preference and actual preference. And this could be quite important here too. At that time, I also went into discussion of what I called multiple preferences and meta-rankings. A person may have different preferences. You may actually order them. You may order them in terms of what best describes your current state of mind, or you can order these preferences in terms of what you would like to be. I wish I'd liked vegetarian food more, would be one such meta-preference. You don't actually prefer it, but you would like to prefer it. I wish I had less craving for smoking. That's more often understood. So these issues could come in once you have preference, but not preference with more structure. Multiple preferences, perhaps even ranked preferences, perhaps against incompletely ranked meta-preference. And then all the problem that we are discussing will come out in quite a big way in the context of autonomy. Kenneth Arrow, in his Fresh Rib article for me, makes the point that autonomy is a little like uncertainty, and given this, you should apply the same remedy here. Now, that's the one point where I disagree with the paper, even though it may be ungrateful of me to disagree on a paper that is written as my Fresh Rib, but that is standardly done by philosophers. They're always controverting everyone who writes in your honor, but economists seem to be very well behaved. But I would say that because it seems to me autonomy is not like uncertainty at all. Uncertainty is something where the nature determines something for me beyond my control. Autonomy is volition. It's for me to determine. It may be uncertainty for you because you don't know how my autonomous mind would work. But if I were to make autonomy the same as uncertainty, something which makes autonomy valuable is lost. So it's a different argument from uncertainty. The fact that I have choice, and if I turn around and say, look, it's not up to you to predict my choice. It's up to me to determine what I prefer, and up to me using that to choose what I would like, given that preference. So in all these ways, even within the preference frameworks, you can actually get much more than just whether your preferred outcome was obtained by you or not. You can take into account processes, when it's relevant, uncertainty, incompleteness of preference, maximality being different from optimality, as well as autonomy, reasons of autonomy being very important. Now, that leads to axiomatic structure, which is, in a sense, some of you might think that the talk is just beginning to get a little interesting when I might go in the axiomatic direction, but I'm afraid I have to end now. So you get axiom structures which are quite interesting from bringing in the multiple preferences. You have various dominant arguments in that kind. And again, you end up, I never try to get a complete ordering. In fact, I never try to get complete ordering over anything. whatsoever. But in trying to get an incomplete ordering over freedom, you may begin even with a complete ordering of preferences, but with meta-preferences, then there are other preferences that you might entertain having, you might prefer to have, and how these come in to the thinking about the issue can be quite important. The Arrow lectures were called Freedom and Social Choice. The book is called Freedom, Rationality and Social Choice, since a number of papers on rationality, including this Econometrica paper I was referring to, is included in it. But there is an analogy here, which I would just mention. Social choice is a subject which was rather prominently mentioned in this kind, in this award of the Nobel that they made. They mentioned that, and social choice is a subject which is concerned with many people having different points of view. The question is there a coherent overall view that everyone taken together could be said to be having? And that's a subject that was wrestled a lot by French mathematicians in the 18th century, Bourdieu, Condorcet, and others, and his modern form revived by Arrow with a famous impossibility theorem. And the question arises, with how is it possible, with so many people having different view, how could you have a coherent view of what the society wants? Now, what the Arrow lecture actually drew on this analogy by saying that an individual who had many preferences has some element in common with a social choice problem. Because the person who prefers to have a vegetarian preference, which he doesn't actually have it, and have some other preferences, dealing with some of the issues we have encountered in social choice theory, and the thought that some of the discussions that have gone on social choice theory may prove to be relevant for freedom, turns out to be not an empty expectation. So that's where it proceeds formally, but since I was going to discuss only these general issues, I think I should stop here and still leave some time for questions. Thank you.
Well, I don't know if there are roving mics around the room, are there? Yes. So perhaps anyone who's asking a question, wait till the mic arrives so that everyone at a different level can hear them. Do you want to take two or three? Or?
I don't mind. I'm full of energy. I'm ready to go on. It depends on when the energy of the population runs out.
We'll
of patients.
That will become evident, I think.
Professor Sen, you started by talking about the difference between free markets and state socialism. That admittedly was only a passing reference. But then it seemed to me you spent most of the rest of your time mainly on preferences, how we recognize them and what we might do with them. Freedom is for people.
If you're holding the mic, need to speak into a few words.
Freedom is for people. In other words, presumably that's what we're mainly concerned with,
yes.
The human race. I would have liked more about the freedom of people to share resources and have choices often denied to them. Could you comment on this?
Well, insofar as you would say that the market mechanism denies people having those choices, then you will making a criticism of it based on freedom. My argument there wasn't either pro-free market or against free market. In fact, in the paper where I discuss it most, there's a paper in Oxford Economic Papers from 1993 called Markets and Freedom, where I argued that the merits of market includes that. Demerits of it, this is not the same demerit as you are speaking about, demerit of it, since I'm concerned with inequality, is that the freedom that it ends up with could be very unequally distributed. But when you are worried about it, you are concerned about the inequality of freedoms rather than just inequality of well-being. That's the direction. And if I were to critique, if I may use that American word, critique the market mechanism, I would go in the direction of inequality of freedoms that markets may generate unless the initial conditions are absurdly egalitarian, which we don't see anywhere. So that argument remains. Now, you were saying that there are certain options that the market may not give, and there is quite a well-developed line of reasoning saying there are public goods which the market may not actually provide, and you may need some mechanism beyond that to have that, and that's indeed the case. and having just come back from India, having crying myself hoarse on the need for public involvement on education and basic health care, that's not a difficult argument for me to agree with. It wasn't my lecture wasn't against or in favor of market. It was how to judge it. What are its failures? What are its successes? Doing it in a freedom-oriented way. The positive points and the negative points both belong to that space.
There's a question down there. And maybe it's people upstairs as well.
Could you also announce people to announce their names, I think, what they do?
Would you like to announce your
just
name?
Just introducing would be
very
good.
And who you are before asking a question.
Rex Brown.
It gives Professor Sen more freedom to respond.
I wonder if we don't have a kind of implicit valuation of freedom in at least American social policy, a kind of revealed preference. In published regulatory guidelines, a value is set on a human life. In situations like a nuclear explosion, the value of the life may be as much as $20 million. In the case of occupational deaths, it may be as little as a few hundred thousand dollars. Even though there's no suggestion of any coherent collusion amongst the regulators, is that the worker chose his career freely, the victim of a nuclear accident didn't. And I wonder, too, whether the reason that we're more upset by 100 people killed by a terrorist bombing section of our socially implicit valuation of freedom.
Yeah, I think the latter part of what you said I found much more in sympathy with, namely that we do distinguish between death which is caused by risk taken by the person himself as opposed to death that is forced on a person because of circumstances of not non-risk taking, that it so happened that there's a nuclear bomb, something happened which you could not anticipate, as opposed to taking a calculated risk. And we might take the same view about smoking, excessive drinking, whatever it is, we could take that distinction. And I think you're right, insofar as we take that view, we do value freedom. But you began by the question of valuing of human life, and there I must say, anything that I have seen on that seems so arbitrary, 20 million or whatever number you do. John Broom, who is sitting here, did a classic paper on that many years ago, arguing why actually most of the standard method of doing it are just riddled with contradictions. But you didn't need that, did you, for your argument? Your argument was really the latter part, with which I happily agree.
I was going to take someone up the top there. Maybe like to follow the idea of saying who you are.
Hello, I'm Karen Gardner from the Centre of Analysis for Social Exclusion at the LSE. My question, I guess, is kind of theoretical, but based on a sort of personal reaction to something that you said. Your title is The Evaluation of Freedom, but when in your talk, it seems that freedom is inherently a good thing rather than a bad thing. And yet, when you talk about the donkey not being able to decide between the haystacks, ultimately the freedom he has means that he dies rather than lives. So in that sense, I wondered whether freedom was a bad thing. And the thing that made me think of it was the choice between orange juice and burgundy, and sometimes just really not being able to decide, making a ultimately having to plump for one, but then continuing to worry whether you made the right choice. So I wondered whether freedom always had to be a good thing or whether that's a bad thing.
I was giving the example of the donkey, of course, to make a particular point about distinction between maximization and optimization. But the point you are making illustrates a different point of mine, which I also made, namely that it would be a mistake to identify freedom with well-being. That is, having more freedom need not work out to be your advantage. And this is an example of that. And if it were the case that freedom has to be ranked in exactly the same way as well-being, then this would indeed be a counterexample to saying that freedom could not be valuable here. But that's not necessarily, freedom is being, it's a different issue. And therefore, it's not surprised. And one can easily get cases when you have, having more freedom may be very bad for your well-being. You hear of somebody drowned. You would have liked to have saved that person. you were not able to do anything here because you were 80 miles away. You wish you were there. If you were there at a great possible risk to your own life, you would have gone in and saved that person. All these statements may be true. And it could still be the case that if you had that freedom to save that person's life, your own well-being may be badly served in this. That's not what you were trying to promote in this case, because there is a possibility you may have drowned, and it's possible that whatever happiness you get from saving of life may be quite different from the deontological obligation that you felt that you ought to really do. You would have liked to have done rather than getting a great deal of well-being out of it. So you can consider a lot of examples of that kind. I had a book called Inequality Reexamined, which was also published by Oxford some years ago, 1992, I think. And you will see that there's a whole chapter discussing whether freedom is always to the advantage of an individual, and the argument that it may not be. And therefore, valuing freedom is really much more of a robust statement. It's not that you're drifting with the tide. You could have gone with well-being, you go with freedom. It's not the case. You have to go upstream in some cases.
Could you wait for the microphone? Wait for the microphone and maybe again identify yourself.
Professor Sen, you sound very confident that we have a choice, a freedom in a market economy. But I'm afraid this is a myth, you know. We don't have any choice at the moment. For example, we have a cartel-like arrangement of supermarkets in this country. We have to accept what they offer. I'll give you an example. I've been searching for the last so many weeks, you know, to find a jar of tomato puri organically produced, you know, organically produced. I have to accept what an offer, genetically modified. We have no choice. It's a misnomer. It's a complete misunderstanding, you see. It's a myth, actually, in my view. Please explain that situation.
I cannot explain your situation to you. I think you know it very well. You don't have any choice of having non-genetically modified tomatoes or whatever it is that you are seeking. That is indeed the case, and there's nothing I can do which would change that. I was not defending, and as I said earlier, I wasn't saying that market gives you necessarily more choice than others. In some kind of choices, there's a whole literature about how, when there are economies of scale, that it is possible that certain choices will be denied to you in the market mechanism. That's part of the literature. What I was mentioning, that insofar as markets are taught to be valuable, why is it valuable? And I was saying that one of the reasons why it's valuable is that typically it tends to give you a lot of choice. Now, if you were to give that example to somebody coming from, to say, Janos Kornai, coming from Hungary at an earlier period, where, in fact, most of the commodities you look for you may not be able to find in the shelf, he may think that you are taking a rather luxury-oriented view as to what the choices has to be. So it's a question of what options there are. And really, I don't want to argue in favor of markets or against market. What I'm arguing is that you have now given an argument, just now, that the markets are not working very well because they're not giving you a freedom of choice. Well, fine. Yes, that's what you have said is an argument against market, not against freedom. Indeed, you use the argument for freedom to criticize the market, and more power to your elbow.
Someone right at the back there. Maybe, you know, people could confess to having an identity since Professor Sen sort of wanted that.
Yes, my name is Alexandra Sivastop and I do a Master's in Development Studies.
I've not located where you are.
Okay. I'm up here.
On the top there.
Oh, over there.
Right at the back.
It's not essential to see the face to comprehend, but it sort of makes it easier.
I would like to ask you if you think freedom is equally important for a rich person as a poor person. In other words, if the value of freedom, in fact, would differ with people's income.
Well, certainly, judging freedom in terms of value for life, as was discussed earlier, one of the reasons why it's wrong is that it tends to go in the direction of what income level will you take the risk of losing your life with a certain probability. And there, of course, the income metric would tend to attach more importance to the freedom of the rich. But that, you and I would probably agree, I hope you agree, that would be an absurd way of looking at it. I would say freedom is extremely important for a poor person. I don't see any particular reason for worrying about that issue, because, you know, having spent about a decade on famines and so on, famine vulnerability is very much a matter of lack of freedom. You die, you don't fast, you starve, you don't have any option, you have lost a job, you haven't got an income to buy food with, you don't have an opportunity of leading a life that you would value. Your loss of freedom is extremely important. Now, I would say, you see, in some ways, the fact that freedom is valuable for a poor person in much the same way as to a rich person is fairly straightforward. But it's also quite important to see that not only the opportunity, here I'm talking about the opportunity aspect, and you might say, well, are you to some extent cheating, because what you really had in mind may be that not whether the opportunity aspect is as important for a poor person as for a rich person, which clearly it must be, but whether the process aspect, do people worry about the process? And I was arguing that indeed they do, and that's one of the examples, one of the reasons why I brought in the Indian elections, the fact that the first time the Indian electorate showed its muscle strongly in shooting a government, when the government was quite confident that it will win the election, was precisely on the issue of suppression of basic civil rights and political liberty. So I think poor people worry about that. And poor people worry about the kind of life they lead. And I think a person who discusses it very extensively and very eloquently is, of course, Karl Marx, when he's even on this famous passage about a life that you would like to lead. I've forgotten the exact wording. If I knew that you were asking that question, I would have brought that quote where he says, I'd like to have a life where I can, weave in the morning and criticize him after dinner. And I think he had, what was it?
Fishing was in it.
Fishing in the evening. I think there was something which indicated to me, convinced me, if I need any further proof, that Marx was a creature of the town, because I think there was farming in the evening or some such thing, which did not seem very plausible, but contemplable from Parliament Hill.
I think he was criticizing in the evening, to be
criticizing
fair.
After dinner. Yeah. You've forgotten. That's a very good moment to criticize. So actually, it's been recognized to be very important to be for the lives of any human being, rich or poor.
There's a questioner in the middle here. Maybe you could wait for the microphone. Going to compel you to give your identity, even though you would have given it anyway, probably.
Sorry, Nick Stern. There's a very important example which perhaps you could discuss of people's choice over how much freedom they want, and that's their occupation. You can do research in a few miles up the road from here, very much the same kind as some of the research you might do here, and you could get paid a lot more for it. But a number of people do have the choice, and they choose one or the other. And there are many examples like that where people really do give up something for having a boss or not having a boss. And having a boss is much less pleasant thing than not having a boss. And there seems to be a whole range of examples there where people are taking choices which involve trade-offs over a very large part of their life, and that would seem to me to be a rich source of discussion for the kinds of issues that you've raised.
Yes, I agree. I think that's illustrating one of the points, namely that we may actually value the process itself, that it relates to that issue, and indeed the case, and it's also very, even this the Fogel-Engelmann book to which I referred earlier on the time on the cross. He mentioned that when slaves ran away, quite often they had lower income, and indeed their life expectancy went down for as far as we can guess. And yet it would be very hard to, when the erstwhile slave owners wanted to rehire them and to use them in the same way, gang labor, which was what was the form, they could not even hire them even at a very much higher wage. And the primary argument that emerges is that they did not like being bossed around, which is exactly similar. It's not at the level of luxury to which the LSE job is, but it's the same issue, and that relates a little to the question that was asked, whether even for a poor person, freedom is very important. And in this case, you're dealing with some of the poorest in the country. I agree. Yeah, these are good examples of that kind.
A question up top there.
My name is Arshad Bharti. I'm doing development management in Destin. My question is, does awareness have any bearing on the evaluation of freedom, particularly in the context of developed and the so-called developing world, where information or a road to awareness is, in certain cases, mitigated, regulated, or selectively promoted?
Well, awareness has a lot to do with freedom, in the sense that the freedom that you seek in terms of processes may involve not only being left free to do certain things, on which often libertarians tend to entirely concentrate, but also a knowledge condition. To take an example, one of the examples of liberty that John Stuart Mill considers in the context of, in his On Liberty, is the idea of food habit, arguing that supposing you consider a society where there are Muslims and non-Muslims, and the Muslims will not like to eat pork, where non-Muslims would like to have the freedom of eating pork. And he argues that society should be so organized that the first group have the opportunity of not eating pork, with the second group still retain the opportunity, and he goes on to that. But you see, if you want to apply it, say, in practice, then, you know, as you can see, this is not a very good example for the libertarian thing, leave it to the person, because the person arrives. You arrive at a restaurant or at a dinner party, and there's a food, and you ask, what is it? Is it pork or is it not? Now, that awareness is part of your freedom, because if you didn't know it, you could not exercise your choice of avoiding pork, supposing you're a Muslim and you didn't want to eat pork, but eating, if it were beef or mutton or something else. So that awareness is a part of freedom, and it's quite important to emphasize that. So I'm glad you raised that question, even though in a very general form, I'm trying to adapt it to the discussion I've had, by saying that you would never be able to get, I think, liberty simply in terms of leave it to the people, look at the processes, and then it doesn't matter whatever outcome comes, he has liberty because he had his own choice, he chose it himself. You might say, well, he chose it himself, but he didn't have the awareness, the knowledge that he would have needed in order to exercise his freedom properly. So the, when it comes to the realization of freedom, it's quite important to have the awareness condition included in it. A person who was working on this whole range of issues and alas died, where the Swedish philosopher called Stig Kanga, who was a professor and he was visited, I first met him at LSE in 1973. He visited the LSE then. He's a professor of philosophy at Uppsala, and he was working on the distinction between having a right and realizing a right. And he would have said here, you had the right to not eat pork, but you could not realize that right without the awareness condition.
I think we have to make this next to the last question, actually. Did you want to ask a question down there? No, could you just wait till the mic comes?
Thank you. Bernard Casey from the European Institute. I wanted to follow up on this question of awareness and we're not recognizing options.
Could you hold it closer?
People not recognizing the availability of options. When you were talking earlier on about what was freedom, you talked in terms almost, it seemed to me, of something like false consciousness about people not recognizing opportunities. What happens when people do recognize opportunities but choose to trade them? Can you have freedom to trade and give up freedom? Because that seems to be the point that Nick Stern was referring to in his earlier question, of people actually choosing less freedom in one sense in order to purchase more freedom in another sense. That's what he talked about, perhaps about the higher incomes from doing research 5 miles up the road.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of discussing false consciousness. I like discussing it sometimes, but today I don't think I did. I'd have to reflect whether I did or not, but I can't think now. But I think trade-off is definitely in your choices. You have to make, you may have to trade off one kind of freedom against another. Consider an example which my colleague Steve Marglin at Harvard very often discusses, saying, I'm quite mistaken in thinking that people value freedom. And there is an anthropological story, it's actually from a book not written by him, where he reads about a Japanese visitor who arrives in New York. And she wants, looking forward to having a pleasant evening. And when he comes in, somebody asks him, would you like a drink? And he said, yes. Would you like a wine or would you like a whiskey? And he says, well, perhaps wine. And then he said, would you like red wine or white wine? And he says, red wine. And he said, would you like a Burgundy or a Bordeaux or an Australian? And he gives one of the answers. Then he's asked another question, and this goes on. And he actually, his enjoyment of the evening is entirely spoiled. And the argument is supposed to be that freedom is terrible. Now, of course, it doesn't, as I discussed in the context of the question that was asked earlier, that freedom going against a person's well-being is not contrary to what I'm saying. But the question is, could it be said that he doesn't value freedom? Well, what he would have preferred to have is, and that's also discussed in the same book, what happens if he had gone, this is the story, he goes, the hostess would have given him a drink, and it may not be the ideal drink, he would have much preferred to have that. So what he is doing is doing a trade-off exactly of the kind that you're saying. He would like to have the freedom of an unquestioned drink rather than a drink only after 75 questions. And that is a choice too. Sometimes we forget when people say, you know, you don't like freedom, but these kind of examples have a tension about it, because these are not just freedom. You can't escape it. You can't take a default route out saying, just forget it, give me it. You have to go on answering it. And you might wish to trade off a lot of small freedom against a large, restful freedom. There's a Bengali saying which says, it's actually very tense in some ways in terms of the word used, that swasti, maybe, which is good existence, may be better than sukh, that is pleasure that you can get with a lot of effort of this kind. While this person is trying to maximize pleasure, he might prefer swasti, that is where he doesn't have to really worry about that. The reason why tension is like so many things that got vulgarized, swastika is derived from the same word, swasti, so that actually its meaning has altogether changed by the time the Nazis adopted that. But the original meaning of it is a good existence, which is a kind of effortless existence, where you don't have to worry about that. And you might prefer to have swasti over sukh.
Well, please join me in thanking Martin, not just for the terrific lecture, but for having devoted so much of his day to the LSE. Thanks very much.
Thank you.